Hello and welcome to this interview. I'm Megan Gibson, co-host of the Sleep Super Conference. Today, I'm speaking with Nicole Shallow, a self-described lover of all things sleep and how to use the science of behavior change to take back our nights and enjoy our lives. Nicole is a board-certified behavior analyst who specializes in the field of sleep. Her work started supporting neurodivergent children and has extended into helping others sleep better through events like this one, her blog, and social media. Nicole Shallow, thank you so much for being with us today.
I'm so honored to be here.
So Nicole, I would love it if you could tell us a little bit about your professional history, because you come to your interest in sleep and behavior analysis through a path that's different from many of the people we feature here at the Sleep Conference.
Yeah. I think my interest in sleep was always there, but I didn't know that I could actually support that piece. I never knew that it was something to be supported. However, it really kicked off in grad school, and I remember to this day, it's like a flashbulb memory. We were in class and my professor said, "Hey, there's no behavior analysts doing sleep. We've got toileting, we've got feeding, we've got specialists in other areas, but no one's actually doing sleep. And there's so much research in our field that shows we can support these children and adults and teens to actually sleep better through behavior analysis." And I was like, okay. Challenge accepted. How I Met Your Mother will repeat probably at that time. But really diving into that, I did my final grad project on that. So a whole semester kind of researching and then presenting the project to my classmates and to other people who are willing to listen. And then continue doing research around that just on my own and getting mentorship from a PhD in, I think at the time they were in the UK, but they're originally from the States. And I just dove into it. It's just a super, it's almost like a hyper focus for me. As soon as I realized we can have good sleep, and there's so many things that we do in our days that interrupt this, that I knew I just had to continue and share the knowledge, because the research, the prevalence rates of sleep issues, especially for neurodivergent children, but also just the general public, have increased tremendously in the last, I'd say, like 40 plus years.
Yeah. And what an awesome thing for your professor, I think you said, to put together, and for you to see the opportunity there for kind of an underserved, not only population of people, but also support, you know, their families, things like that. Like, these are people that need support in an area that wasn't traditionally being served. So bravo to both of you.
Yeah. And I think just touching on my personal journey, because I think that's what stands out for me when I, like, my passion comes from that, like knowing how hard it was for my mother to teach us how to fall asleep. I have a twin sister, so it's double trouble on that one. When we were little, they only had one method at the time. It was the cry it out method. It was very much used in the early 90s, and it just hurt my mom's heart to do that. And so knowing that, and there's no judgment for anyone who chooses that, but knowing that there are alternatives for parents who, if we can do slow change, we can make adjustments so that this process doesn't have to be hard, both on the child or on the parent, as well as, I think I never really truly learned how to engage in that behavior of falling asleep properly. Because in childhood, I had troubles. And then in my like preteen years, anxiety started to rise up, and then end up sleeping on my sister's floor. I think I slept on my sister's floor for multiple years. And it was like, I really wanted independence on my own, but still needed that person. I had so many rituals that I felt like I needed, but now I've learned you can let go of those rituals. They are needed for sleep, and sleep is a natural biological process. It's just a matter of what behaviors we engage in during the day and how to support the sleep coming at night.
Yeah. I love that you shared your personal story too, because what a unique reflection to be a twin, to be parented as a twin, to have sleep expertise, to reflect on your own kind of sleep struggles. That's a unique window that a lot of people don't get. You know, we're all individuals. Even if you're a twin, you're an individual. But most people don't have someone so close to their likeness and genetic makeup to compare to, and to say, like, you know, we were both raised in the same household. We have different idiosyncrasies, but how can we get better sleep and things like that? So I love that reflection.
Yeah, thank you.
So, and you said a couple of things too that I wanted to come back to, but you were sharing so much. Now I've forgotten. So we're going to move on. I'm sure it'll come back to me. So based on kind of, and then after school, what, how was like your entrance into kind of sleep practice and behavioral analysis in your professional life?
Yeah. So I had current clients at the time, and I had quite a few that were struggling with sleep, and we had never really thought about, like, I never really thought about, hey, like, I can help change for this family. And so working together with a colleague at the time, we took on these places. We're like, hey, do you want to give this a shot? We have an idea of how to support you with sleep. And we were able to do it over and over again. And we're like, hey, there's something here. There is a thought that kids with autism or different neurodivergent needs don't sleep. And this is just something that we have to live with, or look at medication and other things to just get them to sleep. However, it was all about just changing their environment to suit their body and what their nervous systems needed to help get them to that place of getting, like, feeling sleepy, and then learning, I go into bed, I fall asleep, and then I get sleep. Because once you can get that chain, it keeps going, because the sleep is the reinforcer, and we'll dive into all of that, the behavior change science, but sleep is so powerful to maintain certain routines. And that's why sometimes we do get stuck in these weird ritualistic habits, because we're just wanting sleep. And a lot of people do a lot of things just to get sleep.
I'm glad you brought that out, because that was actually the thing I wanted to come back to that you had mentioned earlier, was just kind of, you know, sleep routines. And we know that when children are really young, at least neurotypical children, I'll say for, that, you know, they say sleep routines are really important, and like get into something soothing and calming, et cetera. But then moving into kind of like adulthood, many of us who struggle with our sleep develop routines and behaviors and rituals that can then we get so attached to that if they're disrupted, or if we, you know, have a change of scenery or geography, or something gets in the way of that routine, then it's actually causing a problem not to be able to perform the routine or ritual, right?
Yes. And so it becomes controlling. And I think that's where a lot of sleep problems really start. And I have been in that controlling cycle. And I say I slip back depending on certain events that are happening in my life. So looking at that, and I was just, it's the awareness piece. And I hope that today that's kind of what we can provide, is like the awareness of our own habits and our own behavior patterns, and how to flip it so that you still get your needs met. Because at that point, once we're starting to engage in behaviors to control sleep, sleep is probably less likely to come. So it is just learning about our body, how to set ourselves up, how to notice why we're doing things, and why we're stuck in this loop, and how can we flip it and just break it, change it, softly. It doesn't have to be super hard all the time.
So. Yeah. I love that you said that. And and you said the word control several times. And I think that's really the point we're going to try to make today, right? Is that to set yourself up to support sleep happening, but not to control that sleep is going to happen, right?
Unfortunately, like for all us, like I'm very anxious too, and I like control. It's comforting. But control, it is not conducive to sleeping. We just need to figure out, reteach our bodies subconsciously how to get to the sleep place.
Yeah. And I, you know, we hear the word resiliency a lot. But the thing that people forget about resiliency is that it comes from an atmosphere of support, right? So like we can learn to be more resilient around and flexible around sleep and how we get it and when it comes and what leads to it. But that has to happen in a supportive environment in which our needs are being met and we're, you know, getting the nutritional support and the behavioral support and all the things that we need to set ourselves up for success.
Definitely. Yeah.
So I want to get into some of that. All right.
Let's do it.
So how are, let's just start at the beginning of the day. How are daylight and movement related to sleep in your practice?
Yes. So they are huge behavior change modalities that we want to look at. And some of them are actually kind of easy. Daylight is, I start with that. And that's usually my first suggestion with anyone, because it is the easiest thing that we can do for most people. Getting out in the morning is really important. So the sunlight actually anchors our body clock, and our body clock is what we need to get all the rhythms going across our body and different systems and everything. So daylight, if you can get it into your eyes, like that's the key. So going outside, no sunglasses, no blue light blocking glasses, in the morning, hopefully within 30 minutes of waking up, if it's just sitting on your patio or sitting near a window that has a lot of daylight coming in, that's really important to get things going. And then daylight throughout the day. So a lot of, I'd say since we've been in like lockdown and most people are online and working from home, we are more sedentary. We are more inside. Like, for example, I'm in a den right now. There is no windows in here. But I have to make a conscious effort to get up, go out to the patio, take the dog out, to engage in those behaviors, because otherwise I will feel a little bit off later in the day. And then movement. Movement is really important. Again, kind of the same thing. We're not getting enough light. We're not getting enough movement. A lot of us are sedentary and sitting at desks. And I've worked with clients where like, they're like, I was sleeping so well when I was working out, like landscaping or doing like my job outside. And then now they're just, you know, sitting at home watching TV. Or if they're going camping, they sleep like so well when they camp. But then at home, I'm like, okay, the difference there is you're moving probably a lot more and you're getting so much more light. So some bodies need more than others. So figuring out what works for you. And then that's the morning, but daylight is also important in the evening.
Or lack of daylight, right?
Yeah, exactly. As it dims. So our bodies are still on that. We're still on the sun cycle. And so we have access to light 24/7. I mean, we know if you go to Vegas, they light those places up like it's daylight. Like you don't even know what day is night, night is day there. Same thing kind of goes for our homes. We can turn on the lights really bright, but trying to move your day with that light. So in the morning, turn on all the lights, your brightest lights possible, no dimmers, throw them on, open the blinds. And then as the day progresses, dimming those lights, especially in the summer, dimming those lights in the evening, closing the blinds, bringing the lights down, and avoiding too much screen time if you can in the evening, just because, again, all that light is detected through our eyes. And blue light is the one that comes from outside as well as our screens, which causes suppression in melatonin. And melatonin is our kickstarter to the sleep cycle. I think that's a very popular word now. Everyone knows what melatonin is. Here you can get it over the counter, but it's our body actually naturally produces it. We just do a lot of behaviors that interfere with the natural production of that.
Yeah. And I think a lot of people misunderstand melatonin because of the marketing, that it's so easily available. It comes in gummies, like, oh, this must be something that's going to help me sleep. Just the same way that like, you know, acetaminophen would help with my pain. It's like, oh, this will help me sleep. But actually your body's going to make it all on its own if you have a couple of behavior modifications that, that will signal to your body and your brain to produce that hormone and induce sleep at night.
Exactly. And the best thing you can do is just dim those lights. And I have done like through social media, we did like a no screens challenge. And one woman said, I thought I had insomnia, but it was just my phone. And I was like, wow. I was like, that's like sometimes it can be as simple as putting that phone down, because phones can also increase just like excitability in the brain. It doesn't cause that calming effect. And then also just the light exposure and just, yeah, engaging in other alternatives other than screens. But if you are using screens and that's okay, just pop the blue light glasses on or make sure night shift mode is on. And just noticing how your body's responding to the use of the blue light in the evening.
Yeah. And I love those because they're easy changes to make gradually over time, right? Like making sure night shift is on your phone. You don't have to stop all electronics right away. Like you can try really gradual changes. I just recently, because, you know, doing a sleep conference, so every single day people tell me what I'm doing wrong, right? So I just recently changed back to a Kindle reader off of my phone, so that I could try to get more. That's like step one, get distance from my phone in my bed, right? Like next week we'll try step two, which is reading an actual book.
Right.
We'll see.
Yeah. And I think it's also like self-kindness around, again, we go back to that controlling piece. And I know for myself, if I'm like, you can't have your phone, and then all of a sudden, like one night, you know, it's Friday, it's Saturday, it's like a different night, and you've got stuff going on, your phone's on later. Don't be hard on yourself when those things happen. It's just, if it's a habit or if it's a coping skill, like sometimes people use scrolling as a coping skill to avoid like the thoughts
everything.
Come
Yeah,
through.
yeah.
Yeah. Or, and reading is a great alternative to scrolling because you can kind of engage in the same sort of actions. It's not as exciting and it's not as
Depending
immediate.
on what you're reading, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So finding alternatives to those things. And then also, I know my partner, he's fine. He'll use his phone right up until bedtime and he falls asleep, no problem. But I don't push him to do it. I can still do it myself as my own choice. And it's up to them if they want to try.
Yeah,
so.
Exactly. There, I have a running theory that keeps getting confirmed over and over again, but there's always two kinds of people. The people that fall asleep with no problem with, you know, they could drink a coffee straight before bed. And then the people that have more trouble and they get into partnerships with each other. They find each other in the world.
Yeah. Like those people who can just fall asleep on an airplane.
Right?
That's like my dream.
Like
that would
I
be my
could
dream
never. Yeah.
No.
I could never.
No.
You could give me enough sleep medication for a rhino and I cannot sleep on a plane.
Yeah.
That's neither here nor there. I do want to touch on kind of neurodivergence in this part of our discussion, because I know that there's a lot of, I mean, neurodivergence is a very large spectrum of things that all have different kind of traits and with them. And some of them come with kind of more of a nocturnal kind of clock, or can have more struggles, just more wakefulness in the evening hours sometimes. So I'd love if you could talk from that kind of level of expertise and how do we support somebody kind of in that situation?
Right. And so depending on the individual and kind of what they're experiencing, so I can give an example, like ADHD, for example, I would say regulation is a tough one, depending on how they present and understanding how to shift. So like even the behavior, like the skill of ending a task and shifting to another one can actually be tricky as well. So sometimes learning like how to support those shifts, if it's like, do we need to put in timers? Do we need to put in reminders to help move that along, as well as identifying what is regulating. So someone with ADHD, something that may not be regulating for a neurotypical could be super regulating for them. So it is almost like a little experiment, is trying different things, noticing how does my body respond, and then moving towards those that are helpful. I'd say most brains in general, things like scrolling and like social media, like even talking with friends, video games. For some brains, those can be even more reactive and it can be hard to come down from them. And you might feel like you're calm and then you end the video game and then you lie down and the brain is like, you're basically replaying everything that you did because you just can't relax. So that would be looking at like, how do I time it? Because if it's something that you enjoy, it's not something that you should just get rid of forever. It's like timing it and giving yourself that space to unwind. For autistic children and adults, looking at how their bodies again need to regulate. Sometimes they are less sensitive to the subtle environmental cues. So they do need that really clear, like the lights are down, the screens are off, and now there's a routine that is really calming and regulating for that individual. But it takes time and understanding the person and how they respond and what sensory sensitivities they might have and how to reduce the likelihood of a cortisol spike or a stress response, because there can be those things that pop up as well.
I love that you named those, because I mean, really what we're talking about kind of is arousal, right? So even when you were talking about ADHD, it's, and I have two neurodivergent kids and both of them, one of them really struggles with a change in task, right? Unless it's his idea, of course. And so those shifts, like I have to be really mindful of arousal and have to know what his calming factors are, so that if there's no way around this change or the shift in what we're doing next being arousing, then how am I going to then help him regulate himself and help me regulate him? So that we're not, you know, getting into bed and just totally, you know, up and
last thing,
irritated and aroused. And
Yeah, and the last thing you want to do is fight with, like, get into
Exactly.
a fight at nighttime, because now you know the arousal level for everybody is just here, and it's going to take a long time for everyone to come down. So having a routine, and routines are really helpful. Again, routines without super tight control of them, so it's just like something that we move through. Like for me, my routine would look like watch a show, end the show, go wash my face, brush teeth, go into bed, journal maybe a little bit, and read a book. That's generally what we do. And so if you go through the same motions, it will teach your body that sleep is coming, and you'll start to get comfortable with that. When you first start, though, sleep might not come right away. And that's okay. That routine is not meant to control and get sleep going right away, but the more it's paired with that same behavior of falling asleep, getting to bed, and even resting, that's just a good start.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, great. So let's move on to kind of nutrition a little bit and talk about foods, drinks, general kind of what kinds of things are going to assist and support your ability to sleep.
Yes, so for food, I always recommend, like, if you are unsure of like your diet, or if like anything is like you just don't know where to go, I would say talk to a nutritionist, talk to your naturopath, talk to someone who specializes in that. However, just some basic rule of thumb from me is having consistent meals throughout the day. So again, neurodivergent people have trouble with consistent meals, especially if like you're engaged in a task, you might forget to eat. So having a set schedule with breaks scheduled into your day so that you will eat, kind of like when we were in school. Like, I love I need like a
Right,
bell
like
to
I
tell me.
totally, I want somebody to tell me it's time to go to the cafeteria and for someone to give me food.
Yeah, exactly. Because the whole task of even making your own food, right, is daunting at the same time. So it's breaking that down. But first thing is like wake up. When you wake up, have breakfast, and then get your meals and how what works for your body that day, and keep that consistent. And then the foods that you do want to avoid, and this is I think a general rule too, is like high glycemic index foods. Especially some people can be more sensitive to those sugar spikes. So looking at balancing that out, of course, more fruits and veggies. And there's lots of materials online. I even have a blog, I think, of like different from a naturopath who gave some suggestions. But looking at maybe more protein-based foods, low glycemic index foods that aren't going to sugar spike, because if you have a sugar spike before bed, and I don't know if anyone's experienced this who's watching, but like the other night I had a piece of cake like pretty late in the evening. Woke up in the middle of the night like, oh,
It's
we're
time
awake.
to do some mental math on all the things I
Oh my
said
gosh.
and didn't today. Yeah.
Yeah. So because your body can, it will come down from it, and then it just kind of makes you more alert in the night. Yeah, so food with that, and then some examples of different snacks might be like nut butters in the evening. I sometimes have like a little smoothie with like berries because it's low, and like spinach or something. But whatever works for you, just kind of notice how your body responds depending on what you're eating. Sometimes what can happen, and this can be a suggestion, although I think naturopaths don't necessarily recommend it, but it's having like, if you have a high sugar food, you actually do feel sleepy after because you have a bit of a crash, but that might impact like the quality of sleep that you're getting overnight. So short term might be helpful, long term, overnight, not as helpful. So
Right.
just monitoring that. And then what was it? What was the next question? I forget.
Oh, well, I'll stall a little bit while we think about
Oh,
it.
okay,
Yeah, I was just going to say that one of my neurospicy kids,
good. Spicy, love it.
he, because I adore this kid and everything about him, and see how all of the characteristics that make him unique are going to serve him really well in life. I just have to, approach it differently than I would somebody else. But he's a high glycemic food chaser, right? Like it's like if it's a high sugar carb, he's gonna want it. So in trying not to demonize high sugar or like make all foods are good in our house,
All
right?
foods are
But
good.
yeah, right? Like we're not trying to demonize anybody's food choices. But I have started like a little, a little bit of an experiment with him and said, you know, okay, so if you want a banana, because he makes pretty good food choices. I'm like, okay, you want a banana right before bed, because I know what he's after. He just wants a hit of sugar. I'm like, okay, try it tonight. Let's see how you sleep. Tomorrow night, if you sleep terrible tonight, then tomorrow night, let's try a handful of any kind of nut you want. Do you want almonds? Do you want cashews? Do you want this? Do you want that? Like one handful of, and he has a small hand. He's a small person. Like one handful of nuts before you eat the banana. Or like mixing protein choices, fat choices, things like that, that are going to help lower his glycemic spike with that food. And he's noticed. Now he takes accountability. And he's like, Mom, I'm going to go grab a banana, but don't worry, I'm going to eat a cashew first or something. Like,
yeah, I think for most people, like, experiment with yourself and notice how you feel. Because again, it's not about like control, like, okay, now I have to eat these foods that Nicole's told me. It's like, these are options. And again, it's all about the timing of the foods. So if you love sugary foods, go ahead and have them in the morning, right? Like if you're going to have them in the morning when your system is revved up and ready to go to digest and move through. But in the evening, our digestive system and everything starts to shut down. So the processing piece is a lot slower. So it's just timing it and experimenting. And I love that sandwiching the two. So first have the fat and the fatty thing, and then have maybe a bit of this. And you can even shave it down. Like, let's say you're eating a whole banana. You might just be like, okay, I'm going to have half a banana. Okay, I'm going to have a quarter of a banana. And then eventually you're realizing, oh, I don't actually need the banana. It's more of like a habit that I'm in, and it's comforting for me. So again, it's noticing that piece and why we need the banana.
Which, I mean, speaking of comforting foods and rituals, I mean, I'm a coffee drinker.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Like, and the majority of it is, it's an experience ritual, right? Like I've played with like, what is the hot liquid in the cup? And do I really need the coffee or do I really need the ritual? And I have found for myself, I need the ritual. So I'm able to substitute kind of the coffee and the caffeine a lot of the time. But for some people, that morning pick me up, I mean, I think of like shift workers and people who are or somebody that has to be at work at 5 a.m. or something. Like, I get it. Like, if that's not your circadian rhythm to pop up out of bed at 5 a.m. rosy and motivated to do your day, I get why you get the large coffee before you go to work. But how does that kind of stuff impact your ability to sleep later?
Yeah. So coffee or even caffeine in general.
Right.
And the way that you have caffeine, again, looking at how your body responds, I had to cut coffee because I would feel anxious, but I know it's probably just my heart rate going up. So I'd get like the symptoms of anxiety. One mistake is I had a cup of coffee before a big test. And then that was when I realized, whoa, we cannot have that anymore. But looking at how your body responds, some people aren't as sensitive to caffeine and different forms of caffeine, tea versus coffee, green tea, all that sort of thing, Coke. But looking at the timing, how long does it take for your body to process it? So caffeine on average has about a half-life of 5 to 6 hours. So even after 5 to 6 hours, you still have half of the caffeine. So it's still burning off. It's not quite out of your system yet. And what can happen is caffeine, so it really interferes with one system that will help with sleep. And it's adenosine, which is a neurotransmitter that builds up in our system. And caffeine blocks the receptors. So you drink the coffee, you don't feel the tired pressure anymore. So it just reinforces that cycle. And now when you feel tired again, you're going to drink the coffee. You don't feel that tiredness, uncomfortable anymore. And then it just perpetuates. So how to break the habit? Coffee is great. Like I know some people have referred to it as joy juice.
I haven't heard that one, but I will adopt it now.
Yeah. But it is like, why am I having it? Is it ritual? Do I really need it? And shift workers, like they sometimes will have it right before their evening shift. My husband as well, like he does need a cup of coffee because, you know, they're going to be up for 12 hours. But looking at how early can you maybe cut it off and allow your body to process it? If you're feeling sleepy after it wears off, what can you do to help kind of get pushed through that feeling of the sleep pressure? And some things to do are to go outside so that daylight, it reminds your body we're awake, we're we need to still be up. And then also movement. So getting out for a walk, maybe even outside and doing a little bit of that. Just to give yourself an alternative so that you're not seeking the coffee and or the caffeine at like 2 p.m., 4 p.m. Now we're at 6 p.m. like after dinner, or like 7 p.m. coffee, just like nightcaps and things like that. A lot of people say it doesn't impact their sleep. So the ones who say it doesn't impact their sleep, it does, but at a level that they aren't consciously aware
right.
of.
It's more like heart rate variability and recovery and like high quality rest. Yeah, they're sleeping.
Like you don't get into that really deep restorative sleep. So you still feel tired in the morning, and then you go for the coffee, you reach for the coffee again. And now it just like is a perpetual like cycle. So again, awareness of why you're using it. Use it if you want, just timing it and figuring out what timing works for you. If you are feeling groggy in the morning, maybe it is cutting it down to some decaf, because there's still caffeine in decaf coffee, and seeing if that helps too.
Great.
Yeah. Another drink I did want to add though, like I think this one gets missed sometimes, is alcohol.
Yes.
Because that one is a common coping strategy to regulate in the evening.
Right. So if we've had, you know, a cup of coffee or three cups of coffee, and then we're feeling wired, well, you know, have a glass of wine or a beer or something, or a cocktail to bring us back down. But there's some consequences to that as well, right?
Yes. And again, it's all about how our bodies process it. And it can be a subconscious thing. Like you're not necessarily aware of how it's impacting your sleep, but you still don't wake up feeling great. Alcohol actually cuts out your REM sleep, and it impacts the quality of the deep sleep again. And REM sleep is so important for emotional regulation and all of that. And so if we're drinking to calm, I think, again, it's learning, figuring out why am I having the wine, or why am I having this drink right now? Do I need it? When can I time it better? Like, should I maybe have happy hour drinking? If that's like something that, if you feel like that's something you want to do. But if it's a habit every day and your sleep is feeling not great, I would encourage just trying to phase it out a little bit, finding alternatives. Like is bubbly water, like a good alternative to like a cocktail, and like, does it kind of do the same thing, or giving yourself something else to do where you would do that? Cause I do think, and it's in the media everywhere. People have stressful jobs. They come home and they decompress with alcohol. And so that is something too. Like I have, you know, noticed myself doing that in the past. If you're watching a lot of Scandal, that is like all they do in that show. But it is kind of noticing your behavior is why you're doing it. And is that something that you feel like is moving towards what you want, or is it pulling you away?
Yeah. It also kind of depends on your age, I think too, right?
Some
of these less supportive habits that we get into in our early professional lives start to really notice like, gosh, I got, you know, 8 hours of sleep last night, but I feel like hell and it was hard to get out of bed. And you're like, oh, right. Maybe I should start looking at all the things that I'm ingesting that feel a little heavier now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And again, it's not a don't do it. It's a more awareness of,
yeah,
why am I using it? How can I maybe replace it a couple nights a week? Or if I am really stressed and using it as a coping skill for that, how can I support myself in reducing my overall stress? Do I need to ask for help? Do I need to reach out for additional support? And moving towards that.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the most interesting things about producing these conferences is that sometimes with all of the knowledge in the world, we're still not able to change our behavior or put that knowledge into practice. So as a behavioral analysis expert, if I can get it out, why is that we know well, but we don't do well, we don't choose well?
Right. So we just get in these habit loops. And so from when I started my, like just entering this field as like one-to-one working with kids, learning how the science of behavior actually works, I was like, oh, this is why I do all these random things. My sister also has her own like habit loops. And, you know, if we get like caught up in each other's, it's just too much. For me, I'll simplify it a little bit. So there's like a three-term contingency that we look at, and it's a bit of a loop. So you have a trigger in the environment, we engage in a behavior, and what happens after it is something we call reinforcement. So it's either positively reinforcing or negatively reinforcing. Both things maintain that behavior. So that behavior will continue more likely in the future if following it is reinforcement. And so that's kind of how these loops maintain. And some of, like, I wrote down a couple examples that we've kind of looked at already, but like caffeine, for example, is an easy loop to look at. So
I'm alert and productive after I have it. So yeah. I've got a positive reinforcement. Yeah.
Yeah. And you've got, like, you actually, like, I think it's actually more negative too. Like you have, so you have your caught, like you're feeling the pressure in your head. You're feeling tired. Your eyes are heavy. You know, your body doesn't feel alert. And then you have the coffee and that joy juice just brings it. And then it removes that feeling of discomfort that you originally had. And so that is so powerful in maintaining a coffee habit. In order to change the loop, though, you do need to have an alternative behavior that you can plan to engage in to still meet that same need. So you still want to feel alert. You still want to feel good and energized and focused. What can you do to get yourself there? That's not maybe coffee at 6 p.m. Maybe it's something else that we could do.
Right.
And so I think that's the hard part, is people know they engage in these behaviors, but they don't actually know what the replacement that will still fill that need for them. And then that's how we kind of fall back into old habits, because the replacement they tried didn't meet the need that they needed in that situation.
Absolutely. I love
so that's
that
kind of where my lens comes from, because every person is very different. And then there's another part of it that can increase the likelihood that you might fall back into old habits. So in our world, we call them setting events, and it's something that happens in our environment that can increase the likelihood that that behavior pattern will come back or that will show up. And that can be like stress, maybe a few nights, like poor night's sleep, and you're just really struggling because your sleep's just not good. And so you're drinking way more coffee than you were, because it's a coping skill that just is easy and it works. All of those things can also impact. So when I talk to people and when I look with parents and adults and anyone, it is like, what is happening in the environment that is causing these shifts to come back? Personally, anxiety is it's mine. If I'm working so much and I don't have a good enough balance, then that's when like old habits start to pop up again. And so it's awareness. And then I notice it. And if I need it that night, I'm kind to myself. I'm like, yes, you know what? You can watch a TV show to fall asleep tonight. And then tomorrow we'll try again.
Exactly. And it's, right.
Like even as a sleep specialist, like I found myself being really hard on myself, but we're all human. And so it is just knowing that it's okay and you can always get back on track.
Absolutely. I love that. It's very relatable. And you know, so much of our responses to stresses or life circumstances are situational or seasonal or things like that,
yeah.
Right? Like people deal with seasonal affective disorder. And I have a lot of sympathy for people who live way in the extreme northern or southern tips of their hemisphere, respectively, because y'all get a lot of sunlight in the summer.
I know.
Big heavy curtains to like get those nighttime cues, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the sun sets by like 11 some places and then right comes back up at 4. And I'm like, wait a minute. It was just, can we go back to the darkness? That's hard. I know I work, my entire team is in Europe and they're all way, way ahead of me. And so when I started this job, I started a terrible morning routine of like getting on my phone and working. And like before I had even gotten out of bed, before my feet had touched the floor, no one asked me to do that. Right. So I had to like reestablish a boundary for myself so that I could manage my anxiety, so that I could get the rest that I needed, not only in the morning, but also to wind down in the evening. So these stressors and ordinary life circumstances are going to kind of throw our anxiety for a loop, and anxiety and sleep are so tightly kind of interwoven together, aren't they?
Yes. Yeah. Anxiety, like if it spikes, it can really just throw things. And so it's giving yourself, the tools to manage the anxiety. So I always suggest if it's like really severe, like please reach out to a counselor, reach out for support, because sometimes anxiety, the inclination is to just avoid and kind of retreat inwards. There's a time and place, of course, for that, but also finding support to help you manage the anxious thoughts, the anxious feelings, and look at it from a really global picture, because sometimes anxiety can stem from hormone imbalances. It can be like nutritional. There's just so many, it's just so complex. And it doesn't necessarily mean like something's wrong with you. It just means we need to support your environment to help your body get back into that regulated, calm, and relaxed place, because something is off. And like you mentioned, boundaries.
Right.
If you're an overgiver, which like I am an overgiver, and I feel a lot of guilt around saying no, and I, all the self-help books say no. Yeah, it's
Really?
easier
How does one do
said
that again?
than like when you just want to help so many people, but you also have to remember, like, without you, there's no help. So you need to take care of yourself first. You need to put the air mask on first before you can save the people around you. So yeah, it's really coming back to how are you taking care of yourself during the day? And that's where I think my like how I approach sleep is a lot of like, where can we find joy in your day? Where can we help you move towards your values and what's important to you? And sleep actually will get better without only just focusing on the sleep part. Like I've had so many experiences in my life where I'm like, wow, like romantic relationships were a huge stressor. Found my partner, everything was settled, and I never slept so well in my life. I was like, okay, so like there is some parts of that where you're like, okay, when if there's pieces that are kind of out of balance, it's finding that balance and bringing it back in.
Absolutely. The whole life kind of gets a little bit of a look, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah.
Yeah. We're not in any way, shape, or form recommending that everyone quit their job and quit their relationship and go live in a yurt somewhere in the woods, although that sounds
No.
really nice,
It's a
actually.
lot of, yeah. And it's not for, yeah, that is part of like, I think it's managing the stress. There's a lot of, I know you just work, like I'm in Canada and in BC, and there's just, inflation is up. Like there's a lot of money concerns working with people who are really stressed. And they have a right to be. There's a lot of moving parts right now. And we don't know what the future holds. And that can be very unnerving. But just focusing on the present moment, here and now, what can you do for yourself? That will help just kind of recenter things.
Yeah, and I always like to say, if you can manage your anxiety and get great quality sleep, the instigators of stressors in your life won't change, but your ability to respond and your capacity to respond to them will change, which then kind of puts a hitch in that loop of just it all feeling like it's constantly on this slow build to nowhere.
Yeah,
All
that's
right.
great.
Well, Nicole Shallow, thank you so much for being with us. How can people hear more about you and your work?
Yeah, so you can find me at on social media at Your Behavior Gal, and the behavior is spelled with a U because I'm in Canada. So, and then www.yourbehaviorgal.com, and there's a mailing list on there. So if you want to stay up to date with any promotions or any new courses or new, I guess, offerings that
Challenges and things like
I
that. Yeah.
provide, challenges. It is your place for sleep health. Like, and it's, I like to keep it fun. I like to keep it light and engaging. So that's, hopefully you come and find me, and I look forward to connecting with anyone who follows along.
Thanks again, Nicole.
Thanks for having me.